WFM with Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein your way.
Thanks to the superstar Jenny Green, things can only get better should be an anthem at the moment. It's Monday, the 25th of January, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, Stephen Kelly and Fergal Brennan on the sacking of Frank Lampard and all the drama from Old Trafford yesterday.
It is Fernandes. He takes it! Magnificent from the Magnifico. It could be the match winner. The substitute makes it United 3, Liverpool 2.
In hurling, Eddie Brennan is with us to talk about the season ahead, Kilkenny departures and his Laois legacy.
And it's all over! Laois have beaten Dublin for the first time in 14 years in the championship. Eddie Brennan has done it. He has masterminded an absolutely magnificent success.
Plus, we've an Irish Six Nations squad to mull over, and in our sporting highlights of the weekend, I think I'll be avoiding the Munster-Leinster game. But
again.
Stop it. But Tom Brady is sure to feature.
Game on 2FM.
Now, if you want to get in touch, you can do so by texting us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Donica, I was racking my brain trying to think of a sporting highlight. I was actually going to go for a Dervla O'Rourke and fit his families getting four families through to the quarterfinals, but I said you're having a rough weekend. I just wouldn't go there.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a tough week, Marie. And it's kind of all kept on since Thursday with the Liverpool match, really, wasn't it? A bit of a loss to Burnley and then at the weekend, the Munster-Leinster game, which was a good game. It was just the result.
Was it, though? Because it's split opinion. People...
No, it was attritional and it was good. There's certain areas that need an awful lot of work. There was really cheap individual errors. The error rate by individuals was high, but I thought that the calibre of the rugby and it all came down to the 65th minute and Munster, for me, they kind of reverted to type over the last little while and didn't go win it. And you have to be ruthless when you, in big games, you have to go win them.
Okay, well, we'll get into that a little bit later on. I did eventually get a sporting highlight, but it took until last night, well, yesterday evening to get one.
The golf? And
no, Rory wasn't great now in the golf. I wasn't loving that.
Yeah.
I went with the NFL, with Tom Brady in particular, actually, because I just thought he was phenomenal. Tampa Bay Buccaneers last night, heading into that game against the Packers, who were top-seeded. Nobody really expected them to win. They're in Lambeau Field, so away from home, but they pulled off a huge shock. And I think, okay, although Brady has obviously got to this stage of the season and done really well, just seeing him at that level, you know, heading into another Super Bowl at 43 years of age, and just being so impressive. Okay, he did fall away towards the end, but for somebody at that age to be able to compete at that level, Donica, like, you're close enough to that age yourself, like, phenomenal.
He's not even competing though, Marie. He's still setting the standard, isn't he? Like, everyone was on about the Green Bay Packers and Aaron Rodgers and how good he was, and I think it sets it up now for an unbelievable final. Super Bowl is going to be incredible, you know, when you the Kansas City Chiefs and Mahomes going against each other. Someone saying it's like having LeBron James versus Michael Jordan, and I think that's a really good way to frame it. But I think you're right. I think to go into a new environment, like, and to excel, and not only that, to bring everyone with you, he must be a special character. And I know everyone goes on about the bond with himself and Bill Belichick and how they work together, but there's something special about Tom Brady if he can do it somewhere else.
So tell me about that. For somebody to go into a different environment, which is what he's doing and something that you did in your career, how difficult is it to get in and shape the culture so quickly?
Yeah, it can be tough. I think you need to be in a position like him where you can show it, if you know what I'm saying. He's a kind of decision maker, a playmaker, and he can set the, you know, the standard and the performance and the way he plays. But I think, you know, he's I would know nothing about the craft and the initiative, but he's a winner. You can just see how much he, like, that smile every time things goes his way, and just how happy he was on Sunday night to get that result.
I'm not sure how happy the Patriots fans would be, but that is a conversation for another day. Our producer, our BCO Laura Lee, is a big fan, and I don't think she's too happy to see Tom Brady go so far. Okay, so Donica, look, it was wasn't a great weekend for sport, but it was a big weekend for rugby, and then that fed in today to the Ireland squad announcement, and we were mulling over that ourselves towards the end of the week, and who would put their hand up, and just your initial thoughts on the squad, Donica.
Yeah, I think, I'll be honest with you, Marie, I don't think a whole lot of people have put their hands up. I think we're going to have to revert to type and pick the same players we've been picking over the last while. Am I a little bit worried about the standard at the moment? A little bit, yeah. I think we're going into the Six Nations. I don't think any of the other nations will probably fear us in terms of the big ones. I think Wales will be licking their lips to kind of get us first off, but we need to go beyond ourselves. I suppose you look at the squad, and the one that's grabbing headlines is Tadhg Furlong because he hasn't played for a year. I wouldn't worry about that in the slightest. Just put him in there. I am delighted for Rhys Ruddock. Quality performance need to be rewarded, and every time he goes out he puts in a massive performance. So there is people that are missing. The big new caps, or if they were to feature, would be Craig Casey from Munster and Tom O'Toole, to be fair, and they've shown pedigree in underage rugby. And I think they'll learn an awful lot coming through and into squads like this. Ian Henderson's in. It's when we'll probably see him. I'll be honest, there's a body of work looking at the weekend for our lineout.
Go on, tell me about that, because people are talking about the line-out and saying that there's issues within the provinces, and then the knock-on effect that there's issues within Ireland, but no one's actually breaking it down. Yeah. What are the problems?
I personally thought we could fix our line-out really quickly. I thought maybe it's just a little few tweaks, but I'm looking at the moment, Marie, and it's really poor. I think the tempo of the line-outs are poor, the kind of individual spacings, people jumping in different spots the whole time. These are small little things that become really bad habits. Like within the how you're standing, you can jump to your front foot, your middle or your back foot, and you might think that's a really small thing, but that's the difference between winning a ball at top height. And I'm just seeing so many poor lifts. They call it your A-frame. It should look like an A when you do a proper lift.
I know this is radio, but Donica is actually standing up now and he's making an A-frame with his hands and his arms and his shoulders.
But yeah, your jumper should be at the top of the A-frame and the two supporters should be perfectly parallel, so it looks good and it looks right. And there's just been so many sloppy ones. If you look at RG Snaeman getting injured, it was from a really poor lift, you know. And I think this is carrying on, and it's not just one province. Munster were probably the worst this weekend, but Leinster's lineout's really poor. I'm worried about the calibre of our calling, and I think we need a bit of a lineout change in terms of our system. I think, you know, if you look back at the Autumn Nations Cup, England went out and put in a massive, robbed four of our lineouts, and they didn't even have a jump in back row. So that means they only had two pods to go against our three, and they still cleaned us out a little bit. So look, it is probably one of the areas, and of course everyone looked to Hooker, but I don't think since Devin Toner someone has commanded the lineout. And I think there's space there for the likes of Ian Henderson. We spoke about James Ryan. Guys need to step up and run it.
What can Paul O'Connell do now when he comes in? And like, what have you experienced him doing? Like, what kind of changes can he make?
Yeah, I think he has an awful lot of work to do. I'll be honest, I was really confident with him going in there, but I think it's a teaching thing, it's a learning thing. And I'll be honest, it doesn't always lie on the callers. I just remember Alan Quinlan used to torment me about my spacing and line-out. So he would constantly, and Marie, you're only chatting about moving your foot back an inch, but that's the difference between you winning and losing a ball. But he used to police me on that, so it can't all be left to the coaches. To be fair to Paulie, he was a general in that lineout, so he used to march it. I'm worried, is there someone? And he'd always be looking, Paul would look at Curry Cup, he'd look at any rugby to try to find a lineout. So my concern is, are the likes of James Ryan, Ian Henderson, Quinn Roo, Tadhg Byrne, are they doing that? It's that extra work to find a brilliant lineout and to run the system as well as we can. I'll be honest, I was really confident with Paul going in there. I know he'll drive standards with it, but it is a body of work. It's more work than I thought it was going to be.
Is there enough time?
I don't know. is the honest answer. I really
don't.
On
the 3rd of February,
like,
is it?
I think you can tell people, you know, you need to do this better, but for them to learn it and practice it and do it week in, week out, I think needs an awful lot of work. I think, to be fair, he's really good at explaining, so I think that's, you know, but he does need a little bit more buy-in. You know, I know everyone's mad to see Stephen Larcombe's imprint, but if you look at the difference between these two sides, Leinster scored off a launch and Munster didn't. You know, they couldn't get any attack from first phase, which is your best one to attack off lineouts, because, you know, the back line is 10 metres back. Leinster, to be fair, was a brilliant bit of skill, brilliant kick through by Ross Byrne. Hugo Keenan with an unbelievable offload to put Jordan Larmour in. You know, it was just a strike play that I'd be really, really pleased with. But if you, I'd say it must be so frustrating for a coach if you can't get launched. And I'd say Stephen Larcombe, I would feel for him at the moment that, especially on Saturday night, Munster didn't get a foothold in with any of that.
Are they closer, Donegal? Are they closer to beating Leinster?
I don't know. I don't even think that matters. Like, you just...
I think it matters to fans, though, because fans want to... Okay, performances means a lot, but, you know, you don't want to be going into a game thinking your team aren't going to win.
But I actually think Leinster will look at that game on Saturday and go through the amount of errors they made as well. I think there's massive learnings in it for Leinster. If you're to be honest, you know, both teams can come away from it going... You know, they're the ones you love, Marie. When you play really poorly and you get the result and you find a way to get the result. And I think that's what Leinster did. And that's, you know, that's a sign of a bit of calibre to kind of win ugly. And they did that. But personally, it doesn't matter. For me, it didn't even matter this weekend. Of course you want to win, but the tide is with Leinster now at the moment. And you see that in the Irish squad at the moment. It's mainly made up of Leinster players, which they deserve because they've been the most successful. But it's mad. It made me think today, Declan Kidney used to always put up, and it used to drive us crazy, win the Interpros as their number one goal, and we'd all be there. It's win the European Cup, and he's there. No, it's win the Interpros. You have to be the best team in Ireland. And I'll be honest, if you're the best team in Ireland, you're knocking on the door. And to be fair, Leinster have been the best team for a number of years now, and keep setting the blades. So, you know, of course, it was frustrating. I'll be honest, it ruined my form on Sunday because he wanted to go well. And I think Munster started really well. I think there's an awful lot of individual errors that would really cost them. And I know that people go on about the kicks and stuff like that, but that they're the kind of pressure moments that you have to nail. But there was a few knock-ons, there was a few really sloppy penalties. We spoke about the line-out. There are things you can fix, but you need individuals in those moments to be confident and want to be there.
Okay, so you take all that into account and you still thought it was a good match?
I enjoyed it, especially up to the kind of 65th minute and in around the 65th minute, because it was brilliant for me. Leinster took out the knife and kicked to the corner on around 32 and Munster answered it and then went down the other end of the pitch. Munster got a penalty, and to be fair, it was a big kick for JJ, and I know everyone's saying, oh, you should nail them. The fella hit the cross, or hit the post, you know what I mean? He wasn't that far off, but you know at that length, as a forward, your chase line has to be brilliant, because you're going to see out the game at that point. If it doesn't go over, you have to, and Reece Marshall flies in, gives away a penalty, I think. Johnny kicks down the end of the pitch, makes a serious gain line, and then another sloppy penalty, I think it was Tig and James Cronin off their feet at a breakdown. And you go into the half there where you should be 13-3 up to 10-6, and it's just a little bit of a momentum swing. And then straight after half time, JJ missed that important kick, which, I'd be fair, I think he'd normally knock over and probably should have. But look, as a 10, you always get the responsibility. You're the one everyone always looks at, because they're the moments where you got to light up. You got to love the pressure.
And then you got to pack up all your stuff and head into Irish camp on a Monday morning to meet up with the lads who just dealt you a pretty killer blow.
And that's horrible. I swear to God, that is. It really is. That was even tough when you played 3 months out. You know, from Christmas into this time, you'd still be going, they have the upper hand. And look, Munster was disappointing. I watched the Connacht game, probably helped me some bit. And then, unfortunately, Connacht, who had put in a brilliant first half performance, but just didn't see it out. And it was the same thing again. It was just little errors. And I think, I'm fully behind players, and players, you know, it needs coaching and need to be pushed, but there's sometimes you have to as players take responsibility, and small little things like discipline, well, discipline's a big one, but handling errors, you know, just sloppy penalties, they're not acceptable, and we saw too much of them from all three provinces this weekend. So they look, we're in a great position. If I had to have a highlight, it was that no one got injured.
Yeah. That's not a bad one.
Or no one got suspended. I was there like...
Because it's going to come around really quickly.
It will. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, though. Would you put James Lowe and Tadhg Furlong out of camp to be involved with Leinster for Scarlets? And then, I'm just thinking this out loud, but how does that interfere with the bubble that's going to be created within camp? It's the logistics of trying to sort that out with game time. The one thing I do know is the likes, they can get an awful lot of reps in camp. You could rotate between, Tom O'Toole and Porter against and keep Tadhg working the whole time. So whether they get up to speed quick enough or they need matches will be interesting to see. But look, it's good to come into Six Nations time. And look, we got fixtures for the Pro 14 today that'll bring on, I think there's 23 games announced, which is good, because Marie, it must be very tough at the moment, being someone like Andy Friend, Johan van Grand, Leo Cullen, Dan McFarland, to actually know what your next game is. We're into the middle of our season, but we got fixtures today, so it's at least it's a step in the right direction, but it is an awful lot of uncertainty. But yeah, fingers crossed for a big Six Nations. I'm nervous, though. I really am nervous.
You sound nervous, actually.
I am.
You sound a mix of nervous and excited, and we're still a couple of weeks out.
Well, I'm just glad we've Wales first. When I always look back at it, give me Wales first off, because they seem to get better as they go on. They're kind of one of the teams that I never had a problem playing first. And as well, no crowd in the Cardiff Arms Park. You take that, the Millennium or whatever you have to call it now. It's
Principality,
there you go.
Okay, well, we have a squad, we have a starting point, and we'll be continuing our build-up over the next few weeks, because who knows what's going to happen. I do know what we're going to do now, though. We are going to take a quick break, and then we're back talking Frank Lampard.
With Green Firm, healthy snacking made easy with Green Firm's high protein on the go range, available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, I think it's fair to say everybody was shocked but not shocked today about Frank Lampard. It was like, it felt like it was going to happen, but at the same time it did feel like it was a big deal. Journalist Fergal Brennan is with us now. Fergal, what was your reaction to it?
Pretty much the same, as you say. It's a very odd situation where it was expected, but it wasn't, because logically, I don't think Chelsea are in as bad a situation as maybe the sacking suggests, but you just get the sensation over the last couple of weeks that Lampard has been walking a very, 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 very tight rope, and now he's gone. And I think, based on the way that Roman Abramovich operates and Chelsea deal with managers in the last decade or so, we definitely shouldn't be surprised. And I think it's a very Chelsea-esque move, and what comes next for them is going to be massive.
Stephen Kelly also joins us. Stephen, it seems like almost extreme ruthlessness.
Oh, it is extreme ruthlessness, and I think this is what we kind of come to expect from Abramovich over the years. He's done it, countless times with managers that have been really successful for him, never mind managers that haven't actually won anything for him yet. And with Lampard, I think the pressure was always going to be heaped on Mo, with the fact he had money to spend, and he spent quite a lot in the window. So that just went, that just intensifies everything, and he wants a return for his investment, and he obviously felt he wasn't getting that.
Fergal, just on that point, you can understand it in ways that 200 million spent this year, like you do want instant success when you pay that amount of money.
Of course, and I think when you look at his record from last season, we're all aware that he's given a bit of a free hit because of the transfer embargo. He played a lot of young players, got them into the Champions League, got them to the FA Cup final, and the minute that embargo was lifted in the... You know, the keys to the bank account were given to him and he was allowed to spend money, it was going to be a completely different situation for him this season. And whilst I don't think he's done dreadfully, I mean, that's not where they want to be, but they're not a million miles away from being in the top four and challenging for a Champions League spot. But based on the money that they've spent, particularly in comparison to their rivals this season, it was always going to be an uphill task for him. And I think, based on the results they've had this season, there's been a lot of masking of problems. And I think 8 games, 2 wins is a terrible way of looking at it. And I don't think the performances they've put in have not really matched the money that they've spent. They haven't really gone and beaten teams that you need them to win against to be in with a shout of pushing for the Champions League or even for the title. And I think of all the players that have come in, he's had a bit of an issue with each one of them. Timo Werner's had issues with confidence. Kai Havertz obviously has missed quite a few games after testing positive for COVID, but I don't actually think any of them have really caught fire. We've seen bits of Hakim's itch, and when none of these things are working, eventually the trail always leads back to the manager, and particularly when it comes to Chelsea Football Club.
Stephen, such a big club, and obviously there was a little bit of rumours coming out that there was some discontent, but it didn't seem like it was enough really to show that there was problems with these, the likes of Werner or Havertz.
No, and it's hard to know. These players have come across, and you know, undoubtedly they're very good footballers. They're proven in the leagues they've played in before they came, and everybody expected really high things of them. But it does take time for players to settle in, and I think what's probably heaped the pressure on them even more is the amount of money he's spent, and then you comparatively look at Fernandes, who's coming to United, and their fortunes have gone through the roof. And someone like Abramovich is probably as black and white as I look at him. They've spent X amount of money of him, and look what he's done to this team. You've spent X amount on this guy, and we're dropping down the table. And you know, that sounds crazy, but that's how people see things. And you know, you're against your direct competitors. So for Lampard, for those players not to hit the ground running, and I think also as well, you've not really seen a style or a shape about him to see that he's getting the best out of those players as well. So the manager's probably thinking, he's brought these players in, I expect big things of them. If he's not the person to get the best out of them, maybe I should bring someone else in who can actually get them into a style or a shape that will suit them.
So Stephen, tell us about the difficulties that players face when they're trying to fit in at this level. Like, what are the difficulties that players face? We're going to be talking about Luke Shaw in a little while, but look, it took him almost 7 years at Manchester United to kind of emerge now as a leading player. But what challenges do they face?
I think it's a bit of everything. If you're coming from a foreign country as well, not alone language and just customs that come into effect in a different training ground, but then if you're joining a side and then the pressure is on you to be performing at an extremely high level right from the get-go, and you don't score, like someone like Werner, who hasn't got off the mark quite quickly, his confidence is probably low, he's feeling like he's missing the penalty the weekend, probably just something for him, and he's in a position where he can't get himself going. It's very hard to do that then when you're in a foreign country and surroundings are not normal for you, so you don't have what you rely on to get yourself back onto basics and move yourself forward. Whereas the other hand, Fernandes hits the ground running and it just goes from strength to strength. It is very difficult, but it's something that the best players cope with and they can adjust to it quickly. And for Lampard, he's the manager, he's the person that has to be able to get the most out of him and show them what it takes to play in this league, be able to put his arm over his shoulder if that's what they need, to give them a rollicking if that's what they need, find out what these players need as soon as they come in and use what he's gathered, I suppose, from his playing career to build on that and allow them to fit into the formation. But I think his lack of stability in his system and the way he's played, I think, has not helped those players fit in.
Fergal, on that point, who's likely to come in then that can, you know, have all that experience, not only with play and formation, but that's good enough to put the arm around quality players like that and get the best out of them?
Well, the big name coming out in the last kind of 24, 48 hours is Thomas Tuchel, who's without a club after he left Paris Saint-Germain just after Christmas. And I think the way that Chelsea tend to operate in these situations, they move very, very quickly. And as it looks that he is going to be the one to take over, I'd imagine he'll be in place pretty soon. He might not be there in time for this weekend, but definitely by the start of February, you'd imagine he'll be in place. And it is going to be an interesting one because he does have a bit of pedigree. He was successful with PSG, back-to-back league titles, but again, that's always kind of held up against the league or the Premier League or the Bundesliga as not really an equal measurement. And I think he does have scope in terms of tactics, and he does have a bit of a pedigree of dealing with elite players. But we've seen with the issues that he's had with Neymar, with Kylian Mbappe, and even within figures within PSG, that he's not always the easiest person to work with. And going back to his previous clubs, Mainz and Borussia Dortmund, he left both of them under a bit of a cloud. So this is not someone that's going to necessarily come in and immediately get the players on board. He actually does have a bit of a history of rubbing players up the wrong way. But from Chelsea's perspective, we've seen with managers and we've seen the players in the past that they don't seem to do their research on them. Stephen mentioned there with Bruno Fernandes, that's a perfect example of United researched him, found out everything they needed to know, laid the groundwork for his move to Manchester so that he could just concentrate on performing on the pitch. Chelsea do not do that in recruitment of players or managers. And based on Tuchel's kind of style and his very kind of prickly approach, I think this could potentially be another issue for them.
Stephen, will Frank Lampard be able to rebuild his reputation after this, do you think?
The thing is, what sort of reputation does he have as a manager when you really think about it? So as much as you say rebuild it, he went to Derby and they were mediocre. They didn't get promoted there in the playoffs. And he went. So then he got offered a really big job at a huge club. And they did well last season, got themselves into a very good position, Champions League, and that was with young players. But I don't think he has really nailed down himself as being a really top young manager yet. I don't think he's really achieved enough to be able to say that. So I think he'll definitely get other opportunities. It's Frank Lampard, what he's done in the game and his mental side of football. I think everybody's always been fascinated at his ability to continually do what he did on the pitch. So you'll think that he can take that into his coaching. He'll be able to bring that into a managerial, that he's really, really strong-minded, determined, focused, and you kind of feel that aspect of his character from his playing days, he can bring that into his manager. So, but in the sense of what he's actually achieved, I'm not too sure how high up the pecking order he'd be in relation to other managers based on what he's capable of doing with a team.
Stephen, this might be a silly question, but do you think he missed the crowd at Stamford Bridge? You know, when you're trying to galvanise a squad there, he is a club legend. His name goes out over it, the crowd goes crazy. Would it have got a bounce from those players?
Genuinely, I absolutely think that's been missed, because I think even with the way they've not been performing that well, the fans would still be behind him. Like, you look at, and I know Man U is slightly different, but you look at the amount of grace that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been given, the peaks and troughs he had that have been lower than what probably Lampard has had at times, and they're back up to near the top now, but he's gone through really turbulent times, but he's been given a lot of grace, and people have said it's based on the fact of what he did for that club. Comparatively speaking, Lampard has done way more for Chelsea than what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer ever did for Manchester United. I know they're probably held in high esteem to each club, but Lampard, you know, his goal scoring record and what he's won at that club and how he's been literally so predominant in their history, their recent history, is huge. So the fans at the stadium would absolutely have helped, because they would have been singing his name, living legends, and they definitely would have gotten an extra few percentage out of those players. I think that's spot on, Donica.
Okay, we are going to move on now to the FA Cup, and we have a text in, Fergal. Given the fact that Liverpool were without six players and United were injury-free, I think Klopp will be reasonably happy, apart from the fact that they gave away two soft goals and were beaten as a result of a dubious free kick. Fergal, what do you think?
Based on someone who has to attend Jurgen Klopp's press conferences fairly regularly, I don't think he will be happy. He's never happy when he loses a game, even if he does have a bit of an excuse. The FA Cup game obviously was comfortably better than the league game, and I really enjoyed it, because we've come to expect these big matches being a bit of a damp squib. Given the situation with injuries, I think what we're seeing now with Liverpool is not just the absence of Van Dijk at centre-back, we're seeing the fact that he's having to move very important players out of their favourite position Savinho's essentially a full-time centre-back at the moment. Jordan Henderson has played there a little bit as well. And I think the injuries are going to become more of a factor as the season rolls on for Liverpool. But I actually think what's happened is it's been the disruption that it's caused throughout the team. Van Dijk's obviously a massive loss, and Liverpool fans will point to that as a reason why they're not as dominant. But the knock-on effect of the security of having certain players around you in the team affects everyone through it. There's been a lot of talk of Salah and Firmino and Mane and how they're not exactly banging in the goals. I know Salah got two yesterday, but a lot of that comes from the fact that they're so used to that settled midfield unit behind them. They know where they need to be, they know the runs they need to make, and that has disrupted all of this. So the injuries were kind of the start of it, and that's still a point of frustration for Klopp. But from the vibe that I've got from when you listen to him in press conferences is that he's very annoyed that the changes that he's made don't seem to be working, because in the past when he has been forced to change things and move people into different positions, it's worked. This is the first time where he's tried something different and it hasn't come off, and at the moment he looks a little bit short of answers as to why.
Stephen, they are in a bit of a spin at the moment, and whatever about winning the league, it, you know, if it keeps going, people are saying they could struggle to make top four. Do you believe that?
No, I still think that they'll be right in the shake-up for it, and I don't think they'll drop massively off the pace in terms of the title race. I think we've got to keep this into perspective. You know, on the back of the Lampard chat, I don't think we need to be getting too ahead of ourselves. Liverpool are still a brilliant side. They're still the highest, one of the highest scorers in the Premier League this season, if not the highest scorers. But what's happening is they're having an issue of confidence at the moment, going right the way through the team. And I think the absence of Jordan Henderson was a big one yesterday. And you see, when he doesn't play, the effect that has on the other players. There's no doubt in the ability of these players, particularly in that starting 11. And I think once the confidence starts to slowly feel its way back into the team, you'll see them start to pick up results again. So I wouldn't be counting them out of the title race at all. And I definitely wouldn't be counting them out of the top four race.
Stephen, in the seasons gone by, we've been talking about Salah, Firmino, Mane, we've spoken about De Bruyne, Aguero, Sterling, some of the really big names who've become icons in the Premier League. And when you look at Fernandes now, do you think that he has the potential to join them?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think why he is still at this club in the space of a year is nothing short of a miracle. Like, he has almost taken Manchester United single-handedly from the mediocre side who were struggling to some extent for their, based on their expectations and what we expect of Manchester United, to being at the top of the league and people talking about them potentially winning it. And a lot of that's down to him. And I think there's nothing more evident to show how much of an impact he has than when he came off the bench the weekend. He came off and the dynamic, the determination, the energy levels, everything shifted for that side when he came onto the pitch. It was unbelievable. He scored the goal, but not only that, you see him tracking back, he was making blocks in the corner from fullbacks. He seems to epitomise what they need in a leader, and not just a leader in the sense of his vocal ability, but someone that leads by example of how he plays, and it rubs off on every on the pitch. And you can even see Paul Pogba, he's taken responsibility on, and you never would have said that if you played Paul Pogba on the right-hand side of a midfield against Liverpool, where you have Robertson and Mane, who are probably the most dynamic left-sided in any league, to think that he was able to track back and cover and get himself into positions where he was heading balls away in the box, and, you know, never really shirked his responsibilities and looked confident in everything he did. I think Fernandes is a massive part of how it's all going, and he's rubbing off on everybody.
So you really like him then, Stephen, yeah?
I wouldn't mind. I'm only saying that because Ruby's not on.
So you mentioned Paul Pogba there, and look, Fernandes definitely deserves a huge amount of credit for bringing him on and bringing up the standards. But obviously Solskjaer as well deserves a huge amount of plaudits for getting him to play like this, obviously only of late. But, you know, the summer's going to come around very, very quickly, Stephen. What would you do with him?
Listen, it's going to be depends on what he wants to do. I'm sure Manchester United, if they can have him playing and really fully 100% committed to this team, wanting to perform and win and progress as a club, then he's an asset. But as soon as something ridiculous comes out between now and the summer from his agent, or something happens that's going to disrupt the momentum that they have or cause a rift within that change room, then that's when it gets to the point where you're thinking, do we cut our losses and get rid of him? And who knows, at the moment he's pulling his weight, he's towing the line, he's doing everything the club wants him to do. So at the moment it's great, but it's whether or not something happens, or there's a Real Madrid link, or there's a Barcelona link, or someone that he might feel, you know what, this might be of interest to me, and then his agent pushes it, and then that changes it at all for when it comes to summertime.
Just staying with contracts, Fergal, obviously Mo Salah as well has been in the news an awful lot about his, and it seems like he's, you know, back on form again, finding the net. But just in terms of his contract and also just his happiness at Liverpool, do you think that everything is okay?
Yeah, I think certainly in the short to medium term it is. And I think one of the interesting things at the moment, which has seen a lot of speculation die down, is the financial burden of COVID that's hitting the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona and teams that he would potentially be linked with. I think what will essentially decide Salah's future is if he's willing to give the kind of next stage of his career to Liverpool Football Club. We've seen how excellent he's been for them in the success that they've had, but he's 28 now. He knows that the next contract that he signs will ultimately define the best years of his career. And I think prior to the start of this season, Liverpool were 100% matching everything that Mo Salah wanted, matching his ambitions at every turn. And I think whilst there's been a bit of a dip off this season in his form and in Liverpool's form, I don't think mountains have really moved in that sense. And I think as long as Klopp stays, we know that he's now tied to a long-term contract, and as long as key players in that team, the likes of Mane, Van Dijk, stay, I don't really see any major move for Salah, partly because clubs can't afford what he would be asking in terms of wages, and also because I don't think Liverpool have really dropped their standards in what they can offer him as a success.
Brilliant. Stephen and Fergal, thanks so much for joining us on Game On. Quick break and we're back with Eddie Brennan.
Are natural, high in protein, and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
So, Donica, were you focused on the Leaving Cert or getting on the Munster Schools team?
I think it was a bit of both. I'll never forget walking down the hill after English Paper 1. I was going down with a good friend of mine, Tom Olden, and his mom was collecting him at the end of the hill, and Anne Olden came out and she said, Donica, are you bothered about the Leaving Cert? I was there, not really, Anne. And she was there, would you mind staying away from Tom for the next 3 weeks, please?
Right, so you will be up on Carl Mullen's show in about 20 minutes giving tips on the Leaving Cert. Stay tuned, everyone. Now, it is 7:15 and we are going to talk hurling with Eddie Brennan till the end of the show. Eddie, how are things?
Not too bad at all, Maria. How's things? And Donica, how's things?
We're grand, yeah.
We're talking the Leaving Cert, so that'll tell you now what's on the agenda today.
Eddie, do you still have that nightmare?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's definitely a sense of I wish I'd done more.
Well, you can go on Carl Mullen's show then the day after. We'll pass all the guests on. So just in terms of now then, like obviously we are in a pandemic still, Eddie, and you've got a new job with Coola, but are you able to do that job?
No.
short answer.
Yeah, I suppose even the last couple of days now, I think really the impact of it all is for me anyway, is starting to really sink in. Not that it hasn't previously, but I think the structure that comes with weekly training sessions and the planning of that and what happens and probably even the social interaction as much as anything else is what you're really missing. And you know, you're seeing guys there and they're belting away in their homemade gyms and they're working away and they're, you know, doing runs and whatever else it is, and you just say, God, it must be tough on players as well, as much as, you know, everyone, like there's obviously lots of sacrifice throughout the nation in relation to what we'd love to be doing, and there's just obviously the real situation of what things are, and we just have to play this game as it is and suck it up, you know, for what it is and see it out. But there's obviously that side of it is what we all miss, and I think, you know, anyone that has played or been involved in a team, I think probably the biggest thing is the social side of it, because you do enjoy the bit of banter before training and after training, And then there's obviously the bit of camaraderie and spirit that comes from, you know, this time of year where you're really slugging it out of it in what's kind of rough old weather for training. And these are the nights that are difficult, but I think it's always the looking further down the track, knowing that the long evenings are coming, is what motivates you and keeps you going. So yeah, it's just disappointing in that regard, because you'd love to be on the training pitch doing a little bit.
Eddie, I know exactly what you're talking about and building that bond, going through the little bit of suffering in pre-season and all that. But from you, it's an opportunity as well to kind of get to know the lads. I know it's an awful way to do it, but Zooms, phone calls, just getting tighter with them personally.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's because when you're, you know, I think when you go into a setup, it's all about getting to know the names and the faces very quickly. And in fairness to the guys, look, they're gymming it over there, and I probably know a lot of the faces, obviously from the pictures that are going up when they're doing their thing in the gym and stuff like that. So, but there's nothing like the personal contact. I mean, for me, we've done, you know, one or two Zooms, but just from the point of view of even gauging mood and spirit and atmosphere and all that, you don't get that in Zoom. And look, it's something to get in contact with lads, but obviously there's nothing better than getting to know them. And for me, look, that's something, you're going into a new group, you're just mad to get to know the individuals and to get to know the names and just get working. And like you said there, just building the bonds.
So Eddie, just in terms of the standard of hurling in Dublin, so you're quite familiar with Dublin inter-county setup from playing against them and coaching against them, and we've seen Coola do their thing on the national stage for quite a while. How would you rate the standard of hurling in Dublin?
I think it's quite strong. I think the fact that you're seeing teams, you know, that have won the county finals over the last 10 years, and you know, they're pushing hard. You know, they're competing with any of the teams in Leinster. When you'd say maybe pre that, you know, maybe, you know, going back pre 2010 or 11, maybe they weren't. You know, whereas I think when Ballyboden made the breakthrough, you know, and won the four county finals in a row with Liam Hogan, I think that was probably the start of it, because they start really competing then. And you know, obviously enough, I think even when you look at the Carlow, you know, Carlow teams have taken them out twice as well, and like they have taken out quality teams. So I suppose that gives you a sense of, you know, you've Mount Leinster Rangers went all the way to a Club All Ireland, you know, St Mullins went to a Leinster final there last year. So, you know, and Coola have won two Club All Irelands and five of the last six county finals in Dublin, and you know, a couple of Leinster. So that gives you an idea of the standards. You look through the team and the squad, and you say, look, there's plenty of county lads in there. So there's a strong squad, but obviously enough, look, the senior championship in Dublin is tricky. Yeah, they have a good standard, and they're building a little culture in terms of winning that county final. And that's obviously where a strong club team that wants to give itself opportunities, you know, your bread and butter has to be your local championship. And I remember having a chat with Ollie Baker about this a long time ago, and he said, look, when they made the breakthrough with Josephs and Dora Bearfield, he said they longed to get, you know, they won a Club All Ireland, and he said they wanted to get back and win another one. But he said it maybe slightly they you need to focus on that county final. The county final has to be everything. So the bonus of that is it presents you with an opportunity to go further.
And Eddie, we were blue in the face really from talking about the Dublin dilemma and funding and population, and it always relates to football, and hurling comes up as well because they have access pretty much to the same resources and population and that. Just in terms of Dublin hurling, from an inter-county point of view, how far away do you think they are from winning the Lee McCarthy?
I don't know. I think they're back a little bit at the moment. I think they were probably went very, very close when Anthony Daly was there. I think he had a really, really good squad there. He built a really good squad, and you're probably seeing a little bit of a transition period for the Dublin senior hurlers. I think the kind of back end or the older lads now, the Liam Rushes of this world and Conor Keenies and these guys, you know, they were the guys that were probably driving that team forward, and you know, in their mid to late 20s. Whereas now they're the senior guys, and you're looking at, you know, young guys like Donald Bourke and James Madden and these guys coming through. And, you know, I suppose what Dublin really need now more than ever is they need a couple of more guys like that to really step up to the standard. But I think they're back a little bit just at the moment. I think they're, you know, they're in a little bit of a transition phase where they have a lot of young lads coming into that panel, and you know, they have a nice, they have a nice blend. But what Dublin always have, that's always impresses me, is their fitness levels are off the charts, and they are a really, really dedicated bunch. And I think when you have that type of stuff, all you need then is to have the hurling in the right place, and then obviously the one big thing of which is everything, and I think Anthony Daly's probably big ingredient was he instilled in these guys was that just doggedness and that will to see something out and not give up.
And just the fact that you're in a job so soon, almost after leaving the Leash job, Eddie, I'd imagine that it's what doing that and coaching teams is something that you really, really enjoy.
It is, yeah. I think I spoke before about this to Joe Malloy one night about that. I said, like, I think for anyone, you know, moving from playing days and moving on then into management, coaching, I think both are very, very different. I think the rugby model, probably where you have a head coach which is on the field, running the training sessions, running the game plans and stuff like that, and doesn't have to worry about all the other stuff, is probably the ideal model to it, in my opinion. Whereas management is a different animal altogether. You're sitting down, you're having those conversations with county boards or different stakeholders, and sometimes, you know, those conversations obviously revolve around finances, and I suppose that probably even brings it on to even, you know, I suppose the reason that, you know, I suppose stepped away from Leash, really, to be honest. But in terms of coaching, I love being on the pitch and I love that side of it. But I've also, I suppose, the takeaways that I've had from the Leash setup, you know, I got to work with Niall Corcoran and Tommy Fitzgerald, and, you know, Niall is a professional coach by nature, and I learned a huge amount from him and Tommy. And skill of observation is obviously a big, big thing, to be able to stand back and actually, you know, just watch what's going on. I mean, that's something that I obviously learned as well. So it's looking at the different aspects of that and saying, look, what will help you improve a little bit.
And just on the situation with Leash, I think everybody's probably quite familiar, Eddie, that there were some comments that you made about the county board. I'm not going to get into the specifics of them. They were accidentally broadcast and you ended up finishing up with Leash shortly afterwards. Did they have a bearing on the journey ending for you?
No, they didn't, because, look, it, as a standalone thing, it happened and we moved on from that. And the main reason, I suppose, are the game changer really centred around going forward. And I think there was definitely a difference of opinion in terms of the vision that myself and Niall and Tommy had for the lads going forward. And, you know, the county board, for whatever reason, wouldn't support us on that. And, look, that's part of the conversations that you have, you know, and again, what I was looking at was, you know, you're looking at other setups, obviously enough, you're trying to keep moving on and keep moving forward, and obviously there's, you know, for the Leashes of this world to make the step up, you need to be, you know, resourced, and again, you're looking at, when you're going forward into from year one, two and three, obviously the level of support has to increase a little bit, you know, and you know, there was a huge reduction in resources that was available to us, and that was the simple reason, and I think the one thing with myself and Niall and Tommy, we were quite aligned with that. Like, we had a vision of where we saw it going, and it was just at odds with it wasn't shared by the county board. And look, that's their prerogative. I'm well aware that there isn't a big hole in the ground for teams to get money, and I know you touched on it there, Duran, about, you know, maybe geographically there's a difference in that, and obviously, look, a lot of county boards are struggling in the absence of club matches, which is their main source of income. So look, it is what it is, and you move on and you learn from it, and for me, I'll take a lot from it. But it was disappointing just to get to know the bunch of players so well, and even the people that we worked with there in the backroom team. But look, such is life. You learn from something and you move on from it, and it was a huge learning curve for me as a manager, and you say to yourself, look, would you do things a little bit different, and that's all. That's it's like, you know, a job interview, as I put it, you go into the job interview with all the nice things you want to say, you might say one or two of them, and you put it in the learning for going forward.
Yeah, and fairness as well, Leash County Board did come out as well and say that there was no hard feelings between yourself and themselves after it all. But just, I think no matter what level you're at, there's always going to be issues, there's always going to be things to overcome. And I think when you look at Kilkenny this year, this season coming up as well, it looks like Colin Fenley isn't going to be there, Paul Murphy, Ger Aylward, like Brian Cody will have his work cut out for him as well to meet the standards that they set in Kilkenny.
Yeah, it is. It's a difficult one at the moment. I think, you know, even Paul Murphy stepping away, look, I suppose Paul has given an unbelievable amount of service, and you know, I won my last appearance on the same pitch as Paul winning his first one, and or, you know, he was in as a player that year in 2011, and what a brilliant guy he was. You know, so someone like him, his influence and even his presence in the dressing room is a huge loss. And you know, even Colin Finlay, I think, is kind of a funny one, really, to step away for a year. You know, Colin is, what, 31, 32 now, and you think at that age, maybe, you know, the years mightn't be there for you when you come around the other side of it. But look, he has his reasons, and you have to respect that. And it obviously means that Brian has to go fishing and go finding guys out there. Like, he has to, you know, more than ever, maybe get more out of the guys that are in there. Like, so there's a huge challenge there. And you know, he's obviously had a change in the backroom team as well. DJ has stepped away, and Conor Phelan has gone in. So they've a massive season ahead of them. There's no doubt about it. They have definitely slipped back into the pack a little bit. And you know, no one more so than Brian will be fierce disappointed with how that All-Ireland semi-final finished.
And as always, Eddie, when in a county like Kilkenny, you know, you go 4 or 5 years without winning an All-Ireland, the critics do start to surface and questions are raised. And in recent times, you know, a couple of ex-players have raised some questions about Brian and his methods, and you know, just maybe from a tactical point of view. And you've been involved in the game now for quite a while, and it has evolved. Do you think that Kilkenny have evolved enough and adapted enough?
Possibly not. I just think we've seen flashes where Kilkenny have evolved their game. You know, I think most notably last year in the round robin series against Dublin. You know, Dublin gave them a lot of bother with their setup, and Kilkenny then ultimately turned around the second half and went short and worked the ball through the lines. And even, you know, the year before that, you know, they recovered an 8 or 9 point lead to Wexford down in Nolan Park. And I think, you know, in those occasions, they had to evolve their game. And I suppose it's not a case of changing your game dramatically, but I think without doubt nowadays, you have to be very fluid. You have to be able to blend from one setup to another. You have to, you know, maybe tactically, I suppose, looking at the American football even last night, like, that's obviously a very tactical game in terms of setups and strike moves and stuff like that. But hurling has gone very much like that now, that you can't have an out-and-out one way to play. You have to be able to, you know, obviously have your own setup and what you want to do, but obviously counteract what the opposition are doing. I think more than ever in hurling, you really, really need some good observation as to what the opposition are doing, and that players have to be obviously prepared that way. And look, maybe Kilkenny need a little bit more of actual, you know, hands-on coaching. I don't know. It'd be very easy for me to say that because I'm not subject to what goes on in training. And I think, in fairness to Brian, you know, he has more than earned the right to decide when he's going to go. But look, that's the usual. I think no matter what it is, Brian is long enough. I think he knows the drill at the moment, and he is under a little bit of pressure. But look, he'll do what he always does, and he'll do what he believes is right for the Kilkenny team.
Yeah, well, death, taxes and Kilkenny winning matches, that's what we're used to. Eddie Brennan, thanks so much for joining us. That is all we have time for. We'll be back tomorrow with rugby player Alex Popham, and we'll be looking ahead to all the Premier League. Carl Mullen is up next, and a little bit of Donegal too.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farm on the go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with